and welcome into the show. It is Daniel Wortman coming to you live from the Dreamaginate Sports Studios. It is Thursday, December the 5th. Thanks for tuning in. We appreciate it. It is 8 a.m. on the East Coast. This is your super early 5 a.m. I know, I keep saying it over and over again. 5 a.m. morning wake-up call. For all of you early risers, welcome into the show. Thanks for tuning in. We will be joined after the break by a friend of the show. He was on the show a few months ago, right before leaving for New Zealand, Michael Boersma, and look forward to having him back on in just a few minutes to kind of update us on some of the work he's been doing down under for these last few months, and look forward to catching up with him with that. In other news, Vancouver Whitecaps coach fined for MLS amateur comments. Headline, Vancouver Whitecaps coach Mark Dos Santos has been fined for calling Major League Soccer quote unquote amateur. The comments were made in an interview with The Athletic and were in reference to the length of offseason MLS has in comparison with other major divisions around the world. Players at the top level, they have 3 weeks, 1 month maximum on break, Dos Santos said. I'm telling you, 3 months and a half of a break in a soccer season is, it's amateur. It doesn't happen in the world. The Whitecaps did not make the MLS playoffs, meaning their last game of the 2019 campaign was on October the 6th. With the new season not set to kick off until February 29th, although the players trained through November and will return in January, they have a long period without competitive action. A statement from MLS said that Dos Santos' comments were in violation of the league's public criticism policy. You know, U.S. soccer, Major League Soccer has this, like, thin-skinned issue. Like, they don't like criticism. They want their broadcasters to always talk positive about them. They want everybody involved within Major League Soccer to always talk positive. And I get it. Look, we don't like negative press. No one does. No one enjoys negative press. I get it. We all get it. And maybe he could have used a different word in terms of amateur. Maybe he said it in a way that Major League Soccer felt was derogatory. But he brings up a very important point. It's something that has been talked about for a very long time. Having your last match, beginning of October, and your next match, the very last days of February, is too big of a gap. And he's right. For far too long, we've not really taken our first division and thus everything beneath it as serious and made it as competitive as we could. When we look at the calendar of Major League Soccer, starting games at the very end of February and going forward with long winter breaks of 3 to almost 4 months is not taking the sport serious in the way the rest of the world takes the sport serious. And for anyone who's sitting here going, but we have weather issues we have to deal with, you don't think that the rest of the world has climate issues? Has weather issues? Have you checked to see where some of these countries are that continue to play? Have you checked to see how Scandinavia handles their seasons? They work around them, but they don't just take ginormous breaks with nothing going on. What he really means by amateur is he's talking about the gap. He wasn't criticizing the league from a quality of play, although we readily do on the show. That's not what he was talking. He wasn't saying this is amateur hour and this is just a clown circus. He wasn't derogatory in that standpoint. He was just saying the highest level, the competitive level leagues don't take this kind of time off. Now, that's a valid criticism. It's one players, it's one coaches, it's one executives. It's a conversation they should be having. And I don't have any issue with them saying that in public, that we should be looking at a longer season. Quite frankly, I think we should be looking at a completely inverted season. We should stay with the Northern Hemisphere and kick off in August, September, finish up in May. We can work around winter breaks. We can work around weather. And for those lower division leagues that are primarily based in cold weather in the winter, because your footprint, geographic footprint, is all north. It's all in the northern part of the country. There are ways to work with that as well, whether that's indoor facilities or, as Scandinavia has also figured out, maybe you're starting in July and you are taking a little bit longer break in the winter, coming back and finishing in May and then jumping right into your next season. But you're figuring out ways to work and accommodate and get more football played, more soccer competitive matches played regularly. Finishing up a season at the beginning of October and then looking at staying out of competitive matches to the end of February, it's just too long. And the amateur part of this whole thing is not the comments. It wasn't even the disparaging part. It's just the reality. If we are going to treat this as what it should be treated as, professional first division football, professional first division soccer, we should be looking at the countries where the sport is excelling, where it is succeeding. And if we look at those models, we can be inspired by them. It doesn't mean we have to copy every single thing. And we've talked about that in regards to a connected system of leagues and a pyramid and how to basically adapt the principles of promotion and relegation, but make it work for a continent-sized country like the United States. We can do the same thing here with our scheduling. We can adapt. We can learn principles. We can learn lessons. And the ultimate principle that he's talking about is we should not have giant gaps. This is an area where U.S. soccer and Major League Soccer have viewed the sport like the NFL, like Major League Baseball, like the NBA. We're going to give everyone some time off. And we're going to do big chunks of time off. The NFL is going to finish its Super Bowl in the beginning of February, and they're not going to get back into the thick of it until the fall. The NBA is going to kick off in mid-fall, and it's going to finish up in June. It's going to have some time off. Major League Baseball is going to start in the spring and it's going to finish up in October. They're going to have time off. That's not the game. That's not the global game. When we look at how the game is organized around the world, they're not taking 3.5 months off. One of the aspects of the sport that is more important than a lot of people realize is rhythm, flow. Regular training in an organized manner, in a productive manner, in a regular set schedule actually helps prevent injuries, but it also helps create a better flow of play. When you have a manager who knows what they're doing, a manager who can build on an ideology, a philosophy of how they want to play, and they're able to get into a rhythm in teaching that, and that repetition over and over again. That's part of football that makes the sport so great. It's not one set play. As much as Alexi Lalas and others love set plays, that's actually not the beauty of the game. It's not running the Statue of Liberty or a flea flicker like we see in American football. It's not about a baseball manager managing the game or a pitching coach calling pitches. It's not about the timeout in the NBA. It's about the flow of play. It's a different animal altogether. And when it's working well, when you see a team playing beautiful football, and it doesn't always have to be the same style, but you just see a well-oiled, like, just excellent football. It is gorgeous. It is beautiful, but that only comes from rhythm and flow. And it's very difficult when you're finishing your last competitive match in the beginning of October to maintain that or recapture that when you have 3.5 months off. By the time you get into a flow and heading into what should be kind of the downhill stretch, you're done. And then you've got all this time for 3.5 months until you start again. If we zoom out on a macro level and we look at the comments about amateur, it falls right in line with some of the other big picture things we've been talking about on the show. Some of those are how we do the game organizationally. When we look at doing soccer the global way, the way that it works around the world, the way that has produced world-class players, a culture that produces world-class players, when we do the world's game the world's way, you see excellence. You see the potential for excellence. And that includes the schedule. But it goes way beyond the schedule. It goes into so many other aspects. Your day-to-day training environments. It goes into the aspects of scouting, recruiting. It goes into the aspects of solidarity and training compensation. Payments to smaller clubs that develop players. I mean, we are technically doing soccer in America, but we're not really doing it the global way. And there's a big difference between what we do in this country and the way it's done around the world. It's eye-opening. If you've never taken the opportunity or if you've never had the opportunity, I would encourage you to do this if possible, and that is to get on an airplane and go somewhere else in the world. Go to South America. Go to Mexico. If you live in Southern California or Texas, drive, get in your car, go across the border, and go and observe the game in a different environment. Get on an airplane and fly to Europe. Go observe and take in a Premier League match or a Barcelona match or a Serie A match or a Bundesliga match, an Eredivisie match. Take these matches in and just drink in the culture. Observe the fans. We're not doing things the way the rest of the world does them. Therefore, we're having to artificially create different aspects to try to pretend that we're actually playing the global game. Major League Soccer does this with artificial scarcity. They create a closed system to try to drive up value and artificially bump up demand, saying, we're not going to let just anybody in. We're only going to pick one or two, and we're going to make you bid a lot of money for it, and we're going to make this exclusive. Therefore, you're going to have to give us a lot of money. That's one way that we do things. We prop things up artificially. We do the same thing with the schedule. We pretend that we're doing it like the rest of the world, that the games matter. But we set up a regular season that finishes in the beginning of October, and then we go into a playoffs. And if you were the best team throughout the regular season and you get in the playoffs and you get knocked out, it didn't matter that you were the best team for 20 games. It only matters that you lost one. And for all of those who bang the drum for playoffs and say, well, that's the better way, the truth is, the way the rest of the world works is every game matters. Every game is a playoff game. Well, what does that effect have on training? Every club cares. Every player cares. Their game checks depend on it. What league the club, the team is playing in depends on it. Instead, we try to artificially create pressure by introducing playoffs at the end of the season. And what is the byproduct? You see a team like Vancouver not make the playoffs, and now they're sitting 3.5 months without a competitive match. All because we're trying to artificially set up a competitive schedule. And we see this artificial theme continue to play itself out over and over again. We set up development academies and we pretend that they are professionally run, that they are world-class development academies. But are they producing world-class players, or is that just a motto? That's an artificial slogan. We haven't done it yet. We would like to do it. We hope to do it. We hope our academies get there, but they haven't done it. And we're walking around using a hashtag world-class DA. But it's not world-class. We haven't done that. We're artificially creating a narrative that doesn't get backed up by reality. In fact, what's happened with a lot of our DAs is that kids get into these environments and they feel like they've made it, that they've arrived. They're one of the chosen few that have gotten into a Major League Soccer Development Academy. They feel like they are the best of the best, but they may not be. But we've created a delusion, this artificial layer of excellence, when nothing has been proven yet. And our scouting network is so weak, we don't even know if it's right. The transfer market has shown us that we're not there yet. The world sees potential in U.S. soccer. They haven't seen the reality yet. I don't think we ever get there until we remove from the equation this idea of faking it till we make it, this idea of artificial realities. Whether that's scheduling, whether that's our slogans, whether that's how we set up our structure of leagues with an artificial pyramid that doesn't really exist. Because there is no promotion and relegation, there is no definitive metric that says a Major League Soccer crowned Division I is better than USL League One in Division III. On paper, it says that. But what it actually says when you read the paper says it's artificial. It just says that one owner paid more money to get into that league. It says that one owner might have been worth more money to get into that league. It says that one owner may have had a bigger stadium to get into that league. It didn't say anything about the quality of play on the field. It's artificial. We don't have a pyramid. We have a numbered system of leagues. It's not a pyramid of leagues. And it is certainly not connected. Speaking of being connected, if you have not connected yet with Ductic Brand, you need to do so, and you need to do it today. Go to ductigbrand.com, D-U-K-T-I-G brand.com, and use promo code DWSHOW. Do it right now in time to get your holiday presents, your Christmas presents in before Christmas hits. And maybe it's for your son, maybe it's for your daughter, maybe they're a coach, maybe they're a player, maybe you're just hearing about this for the first time. Go to ductigbrand.com. Check out their stuff. It's really, really great stuff. Their journals, their notebooks, their winter gear, all of it. DuckTickBrand.com. Use promo code DWSHOW to get 10% off of your next order. We'll be right back after this. Show. Thanks for tuning in on this Thursday, December the 5th. We are excited to be joined from down under by a friend of the show, Mikael Boersma. Mikael, welcome back to the show. How are you? You are in the throes of summer while all of us in the Northern Hemisphere are heading straight into winter or already in winter. How's the adjustment been so far?
Thank you very much for having me again, Daniel. Yes, summer here. Well, adjustments are going fine. I think I came from European summer when I started here at the end of August, and then it was still winter here, but the temperatures were rising already. So not too bad.
So. You went down there. We talked right before you headed down to New Zealand, and you had kind of an idea of, you know, what was, you know, kind of going through, you know, your mind and the idea of a job and kind of this goal of coming down, doing some methodology and some different aspects with the club. Kind of share with us, you know, what has it been like? You know, you got down there and immediately were able to start kind of observing what was going on and then started taking steps to, you know, to take that job on. So what has that been like? What has that process been like for you?
Yeah. It was very interesting. I actually straight from the plane. We drove first to my place to stay for a couple of days. But actually straight after that, we went to the fields. And for me, it was like a flight of 2 days from Amsterdam to Dubai, Dubai Sydney Christchurch, and then being there all worn out, but still able to be at the fields. We watched some training sessions, and I actually jumped in the whole world here in Term 3. I think it's important to know that there are four terms here in New Zealand. They are equally divided as the school terms, and that's also how football is being experienced. So I came in the last couple of weeks of Term 3. The usual football season here is active in Term 2 and Term 3, so in the winter months. And then in summer, not everybody here is running an all-year program, but we do. So when I came down there at the end of Term 3, it gave me a couple of weeks in order to adjust, to get to know everybody, to see who was involved in football, what kinds of different programs are running in New Zealand, and most importantly as well, get to know all the players of our club.
So in terms of, kind of this process and kind of beginning the day-to-day, week-to-week implementation of the process and your job and methodology, what have you guys done specifically on a week-to-week basis, maybe schedule-wise or what have you, to begin this idea of methodology and really, ingraining into coaches as well as players and others what you guys are trying to do as a club?
Yeah, so my basic idea was, and I talked about this already before I came to New Zealand, to make sure that I as a foreigner come into a new country, new culture, new people. So it has to be, it would be very coincidental if all the ideas I have would be a perfect fit for this environment. So basically the first 3 weeks I started to observe and to listen a lot to all the coaches, to watch all the training sessions, to see what the players were doing, see how they played football. And with a lot of conversations also about, the past. So what did coaches do in the past? What did they experience with our club already? What did they think we should improve on? What were good things already about the club? I got lots and lots of information at the end of Term 3. And by talking to those coaches and those players, a thing that they really wanted was some more guidance when it came to football content and methodology. So basically what I started to implement from the beginning was more joint sessions. So on Monday, our academy, so start of Term 4, our academy started to train together. That means that the under 13s, the 14s, the 15s, and the 17s were doing the same session, where coaches were together as well, and were able to try new things out, to get my help if they needed it, or to dig deeper into the content that we are trying to deliver. The same happened also for the pre-academy, for the under 9s, under 10s, under 11s, and under 12s on the Tuesday. So that's something we're now 8 weeks in Term 4, and we really benefit from that. Also, I think that the players notice that there is some more consistency among the age groups. Besides that, we started a coaching course also for that that guiding purpose that that coaches were asking for on the Sunday. Every Sunday we have a two-hour course where we have a theoretical part. After that, we go onto the field with every week a different age group from our academy, so they get an extra training in order to reflect on that later. And that's also going really well. It connects also pretty well to the joint sessions on Monday and Tuesday, because the same concepts can be used there. Besides that, we have our coaching meetings monthly. And in those monthly coaching meetings, we are talking about the structure. So I talked about it with you before that it's important if your club has values, that those values are actually going to be translated into a game idea, which is general. And the general game idea flows into principles of play in attack, transition, and defense, which are guidelines for the teams in order to organize themselves. And basically, we go from that to sub-principles in zones to our training structure. And I figured that the training structure was already there, but the connection from the training structure with the values through all those different steps is something that we are working on in our coach meetings now. So every coach prepares for every coach meeting apart, and then we are talking about the different options we have and what the club's values are and how everything connects and what would be a good decision for us as coaches to make when it comes to forming those guidelines.
When you have observed these joint sessions, U13, 14, 15, 17s, and the players, how have the players taken to and adapted to this difference in terms of, you know, joint training?
It was actually very, very, very interesting because obviously when you are U13 and you have to face U17s all of a sudden, it's sometimes kind of a shock. But also for 17s to play with younger guys like under 13s is actually as well something that players weren't very used to. And together with the coaches, we noticed this as well. And in the beginning, we didn't really explain why we did it. And that led also to some motivational problems, especially the both ends of the spectrum. And after we told them more about, okay, what we actually want to achieve is that in those exercises that we do, you can move up, you can move down. And mostly we played rondos together. And in rondos, it doesn't really matter how physical you are because it's about tactical ability. And it can be possible that when you are under 13, that you might be tactically more advanced than an under 17 player because in a rondo, that physical component falls apart. So basically with the players and their feedback they gave on our sessions, we were able to improve it by also explaining them why we wanted to train together and why we wanted them to be exposed to different challenges.
And in terms of the genesis of this idea, the origin for this, you know, combined experiment of training the multiple ages together, where did that idea, you know, originate, and what was the why? What was the ultimate reason for these players that was explained to the players for this, you know, joint training, you know, philosophy?
So basically, there were a couple of things that we wanted to address, and the basic idea is based on a theory that's called the zone of proximal development. Some people know it better as like comfort zone, learning zone, and the panic zone. And if you are in your comfort zone, you won't really learn. And if you're in your panic zone, you won't learn either. So we need to try to create an environment where the success rate is approximately 70-80%, where success is still there and basically most of the time, but there are also mistakes for a certain percentage which challenge the players. So if you look at that from a tactical perspective, then in a rondo, obviously when I win the ball every single time and I keep the ball, that's success, and every time I lose it, I'm in the middle, so that would be a failure. So what we introduced here, and a colleague of mine, Joe Cole, was actually very helpful in the research behind it, but also in the practical translation from those ideas, was competitive rondos, where we play 4v1, 4v2 rondos, basically. And we basically have a rondo which is the lowest, and at the other end of the field is the highest rondo. The highest rondo has also smaller sizes, so it becomes more challenging as well in matter of space. And after 1 minute, the one who is in the middle drops down, and the one who was on the outside the longest moves up a rondo. And besides the zone of proximal development, we also thought that it would be very interesting to see those decisive moments at the end of the minute, to see how players are actually behaving in those decisive moments, which are probably in the game also very interesting, because the more time in a game has been played, the more important your moves and your executions will become, because the time in order to fix your mistakes are is running out. So basically, those are two ideas of a zone of proximal development and the increased importance of executions during games, and the repetition of those moments were our main goal in order to put all the age groups together. So if you were always the best in your age groups, or you were always the worst in your age groups, by mixing them up, you are actually coming into a different spectrum where you can try to move up a couple of times, you can move down a couple of times, but you are basically always in that zone of success, what you need to be in order to actually learn all the implicit lessons that are there to learn in a rondo.
So a couple key points I want to kind of go back and revisit real quick.
It's a long story again.
No, it was good. It was very good. But just for the audience, I want to kind of go back and unpack something real quick. You mentioned these kind of three zones, I believe you called it, of proximal development, and you talked about the comfort zone and the panic zone. What was the optimal learning zone? What is that zone called?
Yeah, for us, it's the learning zone, the zone of proximal development. So that zone is the zone that we are looking for in our training sessions, in order to make drills easier or more difficult, and get players into that right space in order to make sure that they are actually learning from every minute training that they receive. The zone of proximal development.
So when you're laying out these, you know, rondos, let's say, you know, a lot of times, especially one of the big conversations that's been happening in Australia, it's also been happening in a large way. A lot of our show in American soccer is around this idea of promotion and relegation. And we talk about it on a macro level, and the importance of opportunity and how it brings pressure. You have integrated into your training sessions a version of promotion and relegation, with the players having the most success in a rondo, moving up the ladder of rondos. The rondos keep getting smaller, tighter spaces, more challenging, more difficult. And then those who, you know, have spent more time in the middle, who have not done as well, are getting relegated and going down that ladder or progression of rondos. How have the players responded to that kind of a training environment? Has it inherently helped them stay focused and increase the competitive level? What has been the response of the players to that kind of an environment?
Yeah, in the beginning it was very emotional sometimes as well, because there's also a factor of luck in there, because if there is no decision made, because there are two players who are on the outside as equally long, then rock, paper, scissors decides who is going to move up or down. And that's also happening in the game sometimes. You've got a setback out of nothing, a referee makes a mistake or whatever, but that kind of emotions that we wanted to trigger, competitiveness on one hand, but also how resilient are you when you actually get a setback, and how do you deal with it? Or do you give up immediately the next minute, and are you 2, 3, 4 rondos down before you know it? And that's what happens in a game as well. What do you do with a setback? And we saw some players who were actually coping very well with it, but we also saw players who struggled. And those players were players that were interesting for us in order to make sure, okay, how can we help you with this? Because it's clearly something that you do for a couple of times now. We tape our sessions as well, so they can have a look at themselves as well after a setback. You can actually time them, how long it takes for them to get back at their focus. And talking about that, we talked with our players about, okay, so it might be unfair, but how is it going to help you in the next one? Because the next minute is already going the moment the last one is almost done. So you're continuously exposed to that competitiveness, but also to that vital moment of increased importance when the minute goes. And some players in the beginning really struggled with that, but after they understood, okay, this is what we're doing, this is what we're training, and this setback is actually a moment that I can learn from, that increased the quality of the rondos as well. Because in the first week that we played, the lowest rondo, they didn't care at all. So they were they knew they were the worst there, they didn't care, they were just goofing around there, and they never made it up again. So that's also behavior. So that's very interesting for us in our academy to see, like, okay, is that something that we want? But also, is that a player that we want to nurture? And we had this conversation in general for the whole group, like, okay, what do we expect from the ones who are all the way down? Do we expect from them that they give up, or do we expect from them to fight hard in order to get it back into the middle section or even the top section? Because it is possible if you get enough opportunities. So very, very, very interesting challenges, very interesting experiences that we had as coaches, but also as players, experimenting with this kind of idea.
In terms of methodology, game model, are all of your teams, let's just stay with this group we've been discussing, U13, 14, 15, 17, are all of your teams playing under the same game model and philosophy in terms of, you know, the tactical ideas, possibly formations, or is there variances there? What is the club mindset in philosophy on that?
Yeah, we started building, and our basic game idea is clear, and we also started to formulate a principle for offense and defense. The transitional moments haven't been touched that much, but below that we work with the TOEFL principles of play, and the TOEFL principles of play are coming back into that internal course that we are doing as well on the Sunday. So the training structure is pretty much set. We basically use the TOEFL training structure from Barcelona, and that's rondos, position play, and a training game. And within those exercises, we are able now to teach the general principles of TOEFL, and that's very helpful. That also gives players in the basics the same idea of play, but talking about the 13s, 14s, 15s, and 17s, there are still some differences in, for example, formation. Because we do not say we want to play in a certain formation at the moment. We haven't developed our game model as far yet that we spoke about it. But what we do is we do play with the same intentions. And that's the most important at the moment. And the next coaching session is up in February, because we just, at the end of November, we had our last one for 2019. We go into the winter, into the summer break here, and after the summer break, we will resume with building what we have as a club. And it takes some time, because we do it together with all the coaches. Everybody is involved, and it also means that that everybody can have their say and their thoughts about the way we as Christchurch United, connected to our values, want to nurture players and how we understand the game.
Coming in as an outsider into that environment, you obviously talked about observing, learning, building relationships, listening to other people's ideas. How has the transition in integration process for the other coaches and yourself with these TOEFL ideas and even some of these other details that you've been sharing in terms of the combined training for U13, 14, 15, 17s. How has that interaction and integration back and forth been between yourself and as the outsider kind of coming in with a different perspective, as well as with those who are already in place? How has that gone for you?
Yeah, amazingly well, actually. I expected more difficulties in that matter, because I think that everybody who is coming in new should first show something before that trust is built. But actually, from the moment I came in, everybody was very, very open, very respectful, and very, very helpful with everything that I asked. So that was amazing, because that speeded things up in the start already. And we had a good thing as well, that like a couple of our coaches already went to Barcelona to do the TOEFL course, and that gave them a head start basically for the moment that I came, and also the training structure was pretty much in place already when I arrived. So for me, it was a head start when I came in, because everybody was interested in what I came to bring, and everybody was very, very nice and also very open to receive some feedback. Basically, it was also one of the things that they had been missing the last period of time. So they actually asked actively for more input, more feedback, more guidance, and that's that's speeding up the process that I wanted to start with them massively.
When you look at the players that you have available, what are their, you know, you're around them, you're around the coaches. What are these players' aspirations in terms of their future and their potential? Are they trying to make it to Europe? Are they trying to make it to your first team? Are they just enjoying the ride? Like, what are some of the conversations you're hearing or overhearing, observing with the players there in New Zealand?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because there are lots of things going on in this country. Also, when it comes to football, you have the school football that's going on. Then you have the national age groups. You have the secondary schools, and then you have the club pathway. And players are actively investigating now. Like, okay, what are the things that I actually have to do? And what are the things that I actually have to not do in order to get a step closer to what I want? Because there are different pros and cons with every program. And for example, if your dream is to indeed make it to Europe as a professional player, then you have to make sure that you're going to this elite pathway where nothing is going to distract you on your way, because it's a long way to go. Everybody knows, because there are lots of our Europeans, of course, who also have that ambition. If you want to go, for example, to college in the US, if that's one of your goals, then there is also a pathway that several programs have their pros and their cons. So lots of different ambitions, lots of different perspectives from everybody here. Make it sometimes a puzzle in order to make sure that the load and loadability is well organized, because there are some conflicts in the programs, and we need to solve that in order to make sure that the players are staying fit, because a fit player will always have a bigger opportunity of getting closer to his goals than a player that is injured and cannot train.
When you look at the level of talent in New Zealand and the potential level of talent, is there a ceiling on the potential for greatness, or is it just a matter of them getting in better training environments? You know, when you look at the country and you look at the players, what do you see overall in kind of a global sense? I'm not talking about specifically your club. I'm just talking in general. A lot of people, you know, make these kind of general assumptions about different parts of the world without ever having, you know, personally seen or, you know, had any kind of experience in a place to go, you know, hey, they could produce a world-class player or they couldn't. What have your observations been so far in that respect?
Well, basically, I think it doesn't really matter where you are, as long as there is a clear vision and a clear idea, and people are really doubling down on that idea, you have an opportunity in order to start a gold mine anywhere. And I think if we look at all the different places that I've been, the U.S., Cayman Islands, Spain, Netherlands, and now here in New Zealand, then you have players everywhere, and players want to do their utmost best. But sometimes they are confused about all the options that are being thrown at them, and sometimes they struggle a little bit with taking ownership. But the moment they really get that, then you have an opportunity. And then, of course, we're at Christchurch United here, and we do have a beautiful facility. We have two turf fields. We have a video analysis system that is that I can turn on all the time, and we can do a lot of things that that I haven't been able to do before. But also, we have a culture where football is not sports number one in this country. Which you probably recognize from the U.S., and you have a lot of things going on, and it's as long as we do not prove that we actually have the best quality training, then players will be in doubt about where to go, and that's something that we need to change. Also, together, I think with some other clubs here in the region, in the country, in order to make sure that if we are absolutely passionate about football and a pathway in New Zealand, that we are actually starting to look at what can we do in order to get it get a step closer to the elite way of training. More intense training, but also more quality training when it comes to content. And if I compare it to all the other places I've been in the world, I think there is opportunity everywhere. And at the moment, I'm here, and I do everything in my power in order to make sure that we go one step into the right direction each day.
In terms of the biggest challenge you see in front of you, what do you think that might be?
The biggest challenge? We have a couple ahead of us. for me, the vital one is whether players are buying into the idea. If we can prove ourselves the next couple of months that and players are not only saying yes, but really doing yes, and are fully committed and fully in, that would be the massive challenge. Because if that challenge is being reached, then I think the opportunities of reaching the skies are the limits.
In terms of kind of flipping that same question on its head, biggest opportunity that you see now that you're in New Zealand?
I think there is enough opportunity to work together with all the entities that that are around youth academies, and I think that the schools and the sports culture here are very interesting. So the biggest opportunity would be to align everything.
And when you talk about the schools and aligning everything, can you kind of give us a little bit of background info on that? I know here in the U.S., a lot of people familiar with, you know, high school sports, yeah, and all of that. What is that there in New Zealand?
For me, aligning means that we are going to take responsibility for the players in our care, whether it comes to workload. So, for example, if I train on Sunday, the school trains on Monday. I train on Tuesday, the school plays on Wednesday. I train on Thursday, and our game is at Friday. Then if they're going to do it all, then it's a matter of time before everybody gets injured. So if we do not communicate with each other and we just put our programs out there and we all do it, then probably we won't have any player left at the end of February. And aligning means for me that every player has to look at, okay, what are the programs that are really going to help me in order to achieve, and what am I going to do when, but also what am I going to skip when in order to make sure that I rest. Because if I rest at the right times, then I'll become stronger. And when I become stronger, I can get the full amount of quality out of any session I choose, whether it's club, whether it's school, doesn't matter. It's about being ready for the training load instead of starting fatigued.
So in terms of that process, you know, that's something that I know a lot of clubs deal with here in the United States, high schools deal with as well. How do you work that process out? You know, how do you manage that conversation? Are you guys able to or have been able to make any kind of headway in sorting through that player workload and that conversation between yourselves as a club and an organization versus, you know, say the school that that player is also, you know, playing with?
Yeah, we attack it from every single angle we can think about. So, for example, yesterday there was a tryout. The players who from my team who are playing in the tryout are not training today because they need their rest. And I am taking responsibility for the knowledge I have about what kind of trial they did, what kind of load that is, how long they need to recover. And that recovery time overlaps my training sessions, both of today, morning and afternoon. So that means that those players do not train with me today because they chose to do a trial yesterday. And I think that with knowledge about load and loadability comes big responsibility. And at the moment, we as a club are ready to take that responsibility because we have the information that we need in order to make those decisions. And we will protect our players in that regard. And we also need to know that that knowledge is going to get out there at the other programs. And we are willing to team up with them. And that's why we have in our office Matt Carruthers, who is taking care of our relations with relationships with the with the schools, and also that's a process where we have to start with a couple of schools, and eventually we have to expand to as many schools as possible in order to make sure that every player who is going to whatever school they go to are being facilitated in this regard, in order to make sure that we align everybody around that that player, in order to make sure that they get the best developmental opportunities possible in their pathway.
So when you kind of, you know, take a moment to compare what you've experienced so far versus your expectations going into it, what would you compare? Like, how would you view your expectations versus the reality? Has it been better than you thought it would be, more challenging, going to take longer, or you're going faster than you thought? Kind of, you know, we talked right before you went, and you've been talking about some of the things you've been doing since you've been there. Compare and contrast your expectations versus the reality.
I think that I went into the whole thing pretty open-minded. Of course, there are always some things that have your expectations, but what surprised me actually was the willingness of my colleague coaches in order to dig in to the ideas that I came to bring, and so in that regard, it's going faster than I had expected. And besides that, I was pretty open-minded, and I pretty much looked at what was in front of us and how I could contribute to all those different parts of the bigger picture. So, yeah. And if I'm looking back now at the last 3 months, then I'm actually I'm quite happy with the steps we have taken and the direction we're heading into, and I'm looking forward to 2020 in that regard.
Last question here. When you look at, you know, this experience for you, your expectations going in, what you've already been able to accomplish, if someone listening or watching this interview, this show, and is hearing you talk about some of these ideas and looking at, man, I would love to integrate something like that into our club right where we are. What would be some tips or some advice that you would give them in order to start kind of rethinking maybe the way they currently do what they do and implementing new ideas like the ones you're talking about today?
Yeah. The most important part for implementing stuff is getting people aboard with your ideas, I guess. So I think it's very important that you have a good relationship with the people around you, the people you work with, and that the relationship is genuine and that you're interested in the ideas of others as well. Because basically, if we're talking about that idea, what we had with the joint sessions, then I really liked the joint sessions, but because of my connection with Joe Cole, we were actually able to connect it to a deeper level and actually look for that zone of proximal development, which he introduced to me. So if you have an idea or you want to create something which is new, the people around you usually have ideas as well, and maybe they are even better or more in depth. So use the resources that are around you in order to implement things together instead of just shouting an idea and say, this is what we have to do, because usually that it ends there.
Fantastic stuff, Mikhail. Look, we really appreciate you coming back on the show and talking about your experiences down under in New Zealand. And best of luck to you as you are in about to enjoy your first summertime Christmas. And I'm sure it's going to be a little bit different experience being from the Netherlands and enjoying a winter Christmas. You're going to get a summer Christmas this year. How can people follow your work, follow you, connect with you, maybe pick your brain to get some more ideas or bounce some ideas off of you going forward? How can they connect with you online?
The easiest way is LinkedIn or Twitter. Twitter is M. Buursma, so my initial and my last name, and LinkedIn is just my full name. I think those are the easiest ones to find. And then any questions, always welcome. So, looking forward to it.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show. Thanks, as always. We really appreciate
you
your time.
Me.
And absolutely. And best of luck as you continue to, build this thing out and implement your ideas going forward. So really appreciate it. And we look forward to having you back on again soon.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you very much for having me, and enjoy Christmas time, and we'll speak again in a new year.
Sounds good. Same to you. That is Mikhail Buursma. He is in New Zealand and doing a really cool work. Connect with him on Twitter, LinkedIn, as he mentioned. He's got some really good insight, and if you've listened to this interview, he's talking about some really cool ideas, I think, that could really help you right where you are. Speaking of helping people right where they are, Charity Water provides clean drinking water to people right where they are, and you can learn more about Charity Water at charitywater.org. We'll be right back after this.
No one, no man, no woman, no child should ever have to drink green water with bugs, with algae, with disease in it. Bad water and a lack of toilets kills more people than all the wars in the world. We know how to bring clean drinking water right now to every single person on earth. And when you can bring water into communities, it truly transforms them. It changes everything. Now you could know that you'd made a difference. You could know that you had truly impacted the life of a family, of a community, of a region. There was either clean water or there wasn't. We believe in a world where every single person has clean and safe water to drink, and we will continue fighting until that happens.
Thanks for tuning in today. Thanks for watching, listening. As always, I'd like to thank Mikhail Buursma for joining the show. As always, I love his insight, the zone of proximal development, all of those little tidbits of information. Pick his brain. Get connected with him on LinkedIn or Twitter. It's definitely will be worth your time. Big thanks to him for joining us today. As always, you can watch the show on facebook.com/WRKMN or at danielworkman.com. Check me on Twitter or Instagram at Daniel Workman. We'll see you again tomorrow.